It's the Dearly Departed podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
And welcome to episode 4 of Dearly Departed Podcast. I am Mike Dorsey.
I'm Scott Michaels.
And this is a very special edition of Dearly Departed Podcast. We have our first ever special guest that we will be introducing for our main feature, Scott's niece. So that'll be exciting. We are talking Disneyland. Walt Disney.
It's going to be interesting because I just got some really great inside stories about being a character.
And not just any character, we'll get into it, but the most special character.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to hear those stories because we've barely even had time to talk about it here. So it'll all be new to me as it is to all of you. So let's start with
hate mail.
Do you get any hate mail?
Oh, wait, grab a seat.
What happened this time?
Well, it's not mail so much. I just really have to be a 5-year-old again and address a person that's on the internet that said some really shitty things about me. And this woman, she's got a YouTube channel. It's called Ask a Mortician. Her name is Caitlin Doherty, I think. I don't know. But anyway, she has this something called the Order of the Good Death. And, she talks about things that happen when you die, what happens when you're cremated, the physical things. It's a very interesting channel. She's got several hundred thousand followers. And she's sort of now veering into the celebrity angle of things. And she did one a few weeks back about Yvette Vickers.
Right. Who's the B-movie actress, playmate, who was mummified and found. And you went to her house before it was torn down.
She was dead for several months. And a concerned neighbor went and checked on her and found her dead. So Caitlin was explaining what had happened and just the logistics of what had happened and how... I'm more personality driven. I sort of know that Yvette was a bit of a, an odd duck, and people were, she was wanted people to leave her alone, so they did, and that's why she was left there dead for so long. I happen to know that the house is going to be destroyed, so we had the keys to the place, and we went in, and I liberated, that's what I would call it, a few items from the house.
Because it was all going to get torn down and thrown in a dumpster anyways.
Right.
Nobody was going to take that stuff.
Right. And so these items are on display in my museum, and the way people could call me what you want to call me. I don't compare Yvette Vickers things to the Elgin Marbles, but basically that's how things in museums get acquired. And I've got dozens of people a week learning who Yvette Vickers was in my shop.
As a result, and on your website and everything else.
Yeah. So this Caitlin chick, she does this thing on Yvette Vickers, and she's first, she accuses me. She said something about theft. She accused me of being a thief, of going into this house and stealing things. Now, is she wrong? I don't know. But this,
I think technically she's right.
Technically,
which
she
is the best kind of right. But
yeah,
but
I'm there. As I said, I'm not going to compare Yvette Vickers to the Elgin Marbles. However, she's, first of all, I guess what really pissed me off is that she took some of our video, used clips from our video,
that we shot there,
and used information that she absolutely got from my website, Find a Death, which has been around 3 years longer than Wikipedia was around.
Right.
Because I know people that were there at the scene, and I know people that can give me firsthand information, and she used some of it using clips and photographs from my video, calling me a thief. First of all, she knows who I am because I've done events for her, for her Order of the Good Death. We have lots of mutual friends. I showed up at the silent movie theater with my hearse to promote her event, and she is speaking as if she doesn't know who I am. And she drives past my office, every day because I know where hers is. I reached out to her several times over the years, not just this time, and just to establish contact because we're both in the death area of things,
right?
And she never responded to any of that. And my mutual friends with her, I reached out about this, and they're all pretty mortified by that
because it was just really mortified.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's what I would say. They were like, "That was really not cool." That's what they would say, and that's what they did say. And I'm sure that there was a conversation between them. But I guess what pisses me off is that she took stuff from my videos, took my audio, took my information, slagging me off on her YouTube show, And then, you know, how many graves have I paid for people?
Yeah.
You know, she said, well, I'm going to pay this. I didn't. I was going to reach out, but I didn't. Well, and, you know, it's just that kind of really bugs me. I know the internet, it's fair game. Once it's out there, you know, anyone could take information and do anything with information. But the fact that she said she described me, she said, Scott was thrilled when he finds that Yvette Vickers' medicine cabinet is still full and proudly produces items he nabbed from Vickers' home. I'm like, all right, the tone of that sucks. Because if you go to the videos, it's all nasty about me.
And I just, I think that's probably the thing that maybe rubbed you wrong the most.
No,
with the comments.
She rubbed me the wrong way. Yeah. And then the rest of it did too.
I think the only thing that bugs me is just don't diss what someone's doing while using that same content to entertain your own viewers. Like, that was the spirit that we had. That's why we did it. It's to entertain and inform people.
Right.
And so you're using the same content, but kind of dissing it, judging it.
I wrote to her directly saying, don't, you know, if you want to use my video, at least ask for permission and don't issue moral judgment over what I do. Yeah. And go back to talk about riding corpses like you should, because she just said in her last video, she said she's going to start creating a new series of uniquely morbid celebrity stories. And I'm okay, you know, I'm tired of sitting back and listening to people being nasty about me because screw you. I don't have to. And I'm not gonna write her on Facebook in a couple of sentences that could be misconstrued. That's why I'm addressing it here because I can do it conversationally. And she chose not to do that when I reached out to her in a kind way. And I never posted anything on Facebook because I don't want to be misconstrued. Sure. So this is my way of saying, screw you. To go back to your rotting corpses and your cremations and leave this shit alone, because I've been doing it for far too long.
Amen, Scott.
There.
All right.
There. Now, I feel liberated of this. I'm going to go out and steal more things.
You just, you know, that was like a Marie Kondo moment. You like, it didn't give you joy and you let it go.
Yeah, it gave me so much joy.
Yes.
It did. And I hope that, I'm sure she'll hear about it in half a second.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So then drama has started. We've stirred shit up.
Oh,
Scott.
Yeah. Here well, we go. Good.
All right. Moving on.
Yeah.
News of the week.
News of the week.
And we are live in the Hollywood area, and
I worry when I hear planes around here. Was there Yorba Linda yesterday where that plane smashed into
horrible.
Some buildings?
Oh, yeah, that's bad. That's, you know, my cousins live over in that area. And they live in Anaheim Hills, which is the other side of 91 from there. But I know that area well. I grew up a few miles from there. Okay, so news of the week. I mean, there were quite a few, not any A-listers this week, but there were quite a few deaths, or the last 2 weeks, I should say. James Ingram, the singer-songwriter, passed away, the R&B singer. He's done a lot of great things. I know him probably best because he wrote PYT for Michael Jackson on Thriller, which is
a
great track. He was a songwriter of that, yeah. Christoph St. John just passed away last night. And so that's fresh, and we haven't heard what happened yet, but I think the suspicion is suicide, possibly, because I think he had threatened it before, and his son had killed himself.
It sounds like,
while getting
it sounds
treatment
like he was in a real rough couple of years
there, ago.
So.
He never really got over his son's suicide. And,
yeah.
And it was that his son killed himself at, I think, an addiction treatment center or something like that.
Oh, that's right. He watched it on
and
video.
And they sued the treatment center, and there was a settlement and all that, but I don't think he ever completely got over it.
He had to watch the video of his own kid dying. How
that's
awful
horrible.
Is that?
And Christoph, he was best known. He was on Young and the Restless for decades, and then had other big acting roles. Other than that, Julie Adams, the creature from the Black Lagoon, passed away.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she was, 90-something? But, yeah, what a iconic something role. I mean, everyone has that picture. You don't know who she is, but there's an image ingrained in you of the creature and her screaming in that one still.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of people that give their teeth for that image, to be part of that part of, you know, pop culture.
Right. Dick Miller, one of these great character actors who seems like he was in everything. He was in The Burbs, Terminator, Gremlins. And if we'll put a link to it, there's a really funny clip that got posted. It was kind of a behind the scenes shot, and he's shooting Burbs, and Feldman was kind of screwing around. They're doing a big group scene out in the street with Tom Hanks and everybody, and Feldman's kind of screwing around between takes, and Dick Miller goes, "Shut the fuck up, kid. We're acting here. Or we're trying to act here."
It's just SmackDown, a little cocky kid. I thought it was really pretty funny.
Yeah, it was kind of funny.
No, I love him because he was a Rock and Roll High School, and he played the cop, and they were talking about the Ramones, and they're just, he said, "They're ugly. Ugly, ugly people." I thought that was really, I liked him. He used to hang out at the Silver Spoon when I used to hang before they tore it down.
Yeah, that was such a spot, wasn't
it? It was. I mean, Shelley Winters was there all the time. Lily Tomlin, I saw her there several times. And that was a neat play. I drank with Scott Wilson, the guy that was in Cold Blood. And he was the old guy in Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just... You'd be sitting there. There's a guy from Tremors that used to hang out. And we, you know, we just shoot the shit in the bar. It was really cool. I love that place.
Yeah, Silver Spoon was like a diner on the edge of West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. Now it's a kind of a nice seafood restaurant.
Yeah,
it's
very
good,
nice.
It's good food, but yeah, it's not.
You know,
I
had to go in because I wanted to see it. And I walked to where the bar used to be.
Yeah.
And it made me so sick to be. I mean, it was very nice if I didn't know it. But it was like I spent so many nights in that place. And so many people I know died of alcoholism because I knew from in that place. And it was like to go to this place.
Oh, the memories.
Oh, man. It was. It was hardcore, man. It was hardcore.
Erica Yone or Yon?
Oh, yeah. Yone, I think.
Madame Ruby.
Madame Ruby from Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
She passed away.
The Alamo. Where's the bike? It's in the Alamo. In the basement of the Alamo. She was great, the fortune teller.
We talked about Bobby Beausoleil in our last episode, how he was granted parole and now is waiting, you know, for the governor to say yay or nay, the governor of California. And just this week... Gary Hinman, his victim that he stabbed to death, his victim's cousin, I believe. Cousin?
Yeah.
Cousin.
Yeah.
He's like Deborah Tate goes to the parole hearings and always speaks out on behalf of her cousin.
Yeah.
You know, no, don't let this guy out. And so she, you know, came out again and was on the news saying, like, no, don't let him go.
Yeah. The murder of Gary Hinman is really part of the reason the whole Tate LaBianca murder thing kicked off. We just have a Tate LaBianca Manson segment in every one of our podcasts, don't we?
Well, it's, you know, one of the reasons we did the 60 Degrees of Helter Skelter is because it's always in the news, and we knew, like, when it comes out every month, just wait.
Yeah.
There'll be something, even though it's been 50 years.
So Hinman kicked off the murders. It was 2 weeks beforehand, and he was tortured for a couple of days and beaten so poorly. Beaten great. I mean, he was really beaten well.
They did a good job.
Yeah. And then Manson came in and smashed him on his high side of the head. He didn't cut off his ear, but he
bisected it. He cut it in half.
Yeah,
or
he
something
just
like that,
smashed him on the side of the head with a knife or a sword. Splitting open his head. And
which
then
they
Bobby,
said alone could have been fatal had it not been... If it was untreated.
Yeah.
But I think the girls tried to sew it shut or something like that.
Dental floss, right.
That's classy.
So, but anyway, he was ultimately smothered and stabbed to death after being tortured for a couple of days. So Bobby was sentenced to die. And
after being found, I think, in Hinman's car with the murder weapon.
And blood on him.
Smart.
Yeah.
It's a good criminal.
Dolt.
Mastermind.
And then what, Lady Gaga is using a couple of his songs on her documentary.
From Lucifer Rising.
Yeah.
A couple of tracks from that, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So Bobby's not going to get out. Now, also okayed in the last week was Leslie Van Houten by the parole board. And a misleading thought is that she was sentenced to die, and she just wasn't. During the first trial, her attorney died, and she was given two subsequent trials. She was actually out for several months, and she worked as a secretary. Ultimately, she was sentenced to life with the chance of parole in 7 years, thus making her eligible for parole probably in the early 80s, probably 82, 83.
Mm-hmm.
So Leslie did not cause anyone's death. I'm not defending her if it was my family. I am defending her in a sense that if the laws were followed, Leslie would be out because she was approved.
Yeah.
So now Leslie Van Houten is a political prisoner because there's no way a governor who just started in office is going to say it's okay.
Off.
Yeah, he will just veto it. So I'm not saying I want her out. I'm saying that had the laws been followed properly, she'd probably be out.
I think it's just because of the aura around the Manson family, those people are just never getting out.
Yeah, if you took her last name away and called her Leslie X, you know, she'd have been released 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And then lastly, I wanted to talk about, this is a local one, but Alan Cantor of Cantor's Deli, famous, famous deli over on Fairfax, just passed away at the age of, I think, 82.
Yeah.
And Cantor's, of course, is a major L.A. fixture going all the way back to the 20s.
Cantor's in the 60s was it was Cantor's and Ben Franks were the people that would serve long hairs. There were literally signs in windows saying no hippies allowed, no long hairs allowed.
And Cantor's were the only places.
Cantor's and Ben Franks would let 24 hours anyone could go in. So people like, you know, John Lennon and Bob Dylan, you know, were seen at these places many times because they just weren't hassling.
And
people.
Cantor's is one of those places, you know, when a place is open 24 hours a day, the crowd that's there for dinner at like 5 o'clock is completely different from the crowd that's there at 2 o'clock in the morning.
They do have one of the best dive bars in there. The Kibitz Room is an awesome bar. And I know one of the old Spoon people, Tina Stevens, she does a night there and she's like, lounge, total lounge, and she's hilarious. It's like, hey kids, how you doing? she's fantastic.
And that's one of the, every celebrity alive probably has been there at some point, at least in Hollywood. Even Kurt Cobain for a time lived a few blocks east of there on I think Spalding, and supposedly would walk over from his little apartment that he kept there after he got big and famous. They wanted a place in L.A.
Yeah, so it was really close.
He could just walk. He would just walk over there and eat at Cantor's, and Guns N' Roses had ties to it.
I think that, Lisa Jordan from L.A. Woman Tour, she told me that there's a photograph of them, either maybe used on an album or just a very well-known.
Like in a booth.
Yeah.
And the son, Cantor's son, who runs it now, wrote a book about Guns N' Roses in 2007.
So
there's a whole connection between Guns N' Roses and Cantor's, too. Yeah, so it's... it's just one of those mythical Hollywood places.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, one last thing. Also, we had a Black Dahlia anniversary, death-iversary, and you're doing something special for the Black Dahlia now.
Yeah, we just launched a Black Dahlia mystery tour, and it's really comprehensive. It's really interesting because instead of just talking about this woman who was cut in half and everything else, I mean, just horrific what happened to her, it talks more about being a female, being a woman in Hollywood in 1947, 46, 45, and what it was like as a woman on your own in Hollywood trying to make it in the business or some other way just to support yourself, and how she was chewed up and spat out by men, and different facets of the case and different sort of potential killers. And really, she suffered before she died at the hands of some really scummy people. And like one of the best known theories is the Steve Hodell thing, who said his father, George Hodell, did it.
Black Dahlia Avenger book. Yeah.
And there's a lot of legitimacy to that. Not so much in Steve Hodell's book, but that George Hodell was a dirtbag and a scumbag. And he was like Man Ray, who was the artist, and John Huston.
He was involved with the whole surrealist art movement. Yeah. He was, you know, a supporter of that. And I read a book that was kind of, it took that theory and ran with it. It's an art book. And it basically explores the Black Dahlia murder from the perspective of surrealist art.
That book.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
It's basically the claim is that she was a real life version of a surrealist art, the way she was bisected and her pose was a common pose in the surrealist art world.
Called Matador or something.
I can't remember.
What was the name of that particular image? And then the lips one, the famous lips one over Griffith Park of the observatory. And they say that that might have been George Hodell's acknowledgement of Man Ray's art by cutting her from ear to ear.
And the way kind of shapes were cut out of her skin.
Yeah.
You know, the triangle was cut out of her. I think they cut off a rose tattoo or something that was on her leg and stuff like that.
I mean, what happened to her was creativity. That's what sucks, is that somebody sat back and said, what'll I do next?
Yeah, and then, you know, but then the counter argument to that is that it was just a mob killing. She was going to squeal, and the whole thing was just to send a message to it could be something as crazy and out there as, oh, she was a human piece of surrealist art, down to just, they were just sending a message to the other girls, don't talk.
She was
or,
one of
you
those,
know, was obsessed person. Or,
yeah, it was one of those convenient deaths, certainly. Not like Marilyn Monroe or Princess Diana, where everyone just kind of went, don't have to worry about that anymore. But it was, but like, you know, hers, there were a lot of people that benefited from her not being around anymore, because she did have a lot of information about a lot of different people. And I'm not saying she was manipulating people. She may have been, because she wasn't a stupid person. She was very smart, and she knew her charms, and she knew her beauty, and she knew what she could get away with and how she could manipulate people.
Right.
So she may have just messed with the wrong person who wanted her just to shut up.
There's another, well, the thing about the Hodel theory, sorry to returning this into a Black Dahlia show because it's so fascinating, but the one thing I like about the Hodel theory is I don't think, like, the photo evidence they have, oh, I found her picture in this, but that's not her.
That's nonsense.
It does not look nothing. But it's possible that he just lucked into a correct thing even with the wrong evidence.
George Hodel was a suspect, legitimately.
Right,
a suspect
he was investigated, and they taped him.
Yeah.
And remember, that's the thing that's most fascinating to me about the Hodel theory is that they got that audio recording of him talking. His assistant had died, I think. His female secretary or someone had died, remember?
Yes.
He made he's talking on the tape about, no one can talk to her anymore, you know? Yeah. She's gone now. Basically indicating that there was something. But at the same time, people got to realize he could have been involved in other nefarious activities.
Oh, he
nothing
was.
To do with the murder.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, people don't realize that you see things in a bubble. Oh, he must have been talking about that, but it could have been any number of things.
I mean, this new show, because we did some press for this show,
I Am the
Night.
Yeah, with Chris Pine on TNT that just launched a few days ago.
Right. We had the director on the tour, and they wanted to... Well, they were doing some press. LA Times was interviewing him, and they used us as the vehicle.
The vehicle.
And what's important is that, you know, William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper magnate who Hearst Papers, I mean, he owns so many papers around the country. One of his main reporters was on the heels of this, was really coming close to solving this thing. And it was someone else that was murdered along with Elizabeth Short.
Uh-huh.
And this female, it was a friend of Hearst's. That their daughter was murdered in this horrific way, and this particular Aggie, I forget her last name, but she was on it, and Hearst took her off the case and gave her a promotion. She was the first woman to have this high profile job at the LA Herald Examiner to shut her up because he was trying to save his friend's misery because she was dredging this thing up. So it just shows the power of somebody you can abuse the press, like go figure.
right.
But you know, it just a personal vendetta or a, you know, we're gonna put a kibosh on the news because my friends are hurt, their feelings are hurt. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
But he was an awful man.
Well, Hearst was notorious for yellow journalism and using the press as his tool, basically, to go after people.
He was an awful person. And so was George Hodel. And so was Man Ray. And so was John Huston.
There's a more recent book that I really want to get. People have recommended to me, Black Dahlia, Red Rose.
Oh, I've heard about
the
it.
The Crime, Corruption, and Cover-Up of America's Greatest Unsolved Murder by, I'm not going to pronounce this name right. I think it was a female author. Piyu? Piyu? P-I-U is a first name. Eatwell.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I've never seen that name before, so I don't know how to pronounce it. But anyways, it came out just over a year ago. And I think this is the one that claims basically to have found the murder location and that it had to do with she had fallen in with this group of this gang of criminals that were robbing hotels. And the way they would do it is one of the guys would get a job at the hotel to infiltrate it. And then he would figure out, okay, here's where the money gets stored and here's how we can get at it. And then he'd quit his job after a few days and then the gang would show up and rob the place. Mm-hmm. And they would know where to go and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she supposedly was involved in this scheme or knew them and had threatened to talk or something like that, and they basically killed her. And she apparently has found, there was this motel, kind of like cottages type motel, and the owners called the police because the room was covered in blood. Obviously somebody had been killed there very horribly, and it just kind of matched, you know, the crime scene matched how she was killed.
Yeah.
So I really want to read it and see if
that hotel is on our tour, too.
It's still around. I was hoping it would be.
It's right near USC.
Okay.
And, Just full disclosure, it was my someone who works for me, our manager of Dilly Departed. Her name's Jonesy. And Jonesy did most of the legwork for this thing, almost all of it.
All the locations.
And she, you know, just... She's voracious when it comes to this research, and she did so much research on Beth Short and legitimate research. It's not opinion. It's actually, you know, these are the things that happened. Unfortunately, the case will never be solved. It cannot ever be solved. It's impossible.
It's unsolvable now because everybody's dead that had anything.
Well, no, but
to
the
do
documents
it,
are missing. The coroner's office does not even have the documents. Yeah. They've been stolen over the years.
And,
and
the LAPD will never open up case files because, as far as they're concerned, it's still an active, unopened, unsolved case, so they aren't going to open. You can't get the case
even
files
if someone comes
it.
In with DNA evidence, they're not going to be able to do anything with it because there's no documents.
There's
nothing. It's so sad.
I mean, it's the most shocking murder in LA history. Maybe parallel only to the Sharon Tate murders.
Yeah.
And it was never solved. That's
crazy.
Yeah,
it's like America's Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really. All right. Now, main feature.
It's time for the main feature.
Okay, the main feature is a big one because I am definitely a Disney kid. I'm from Orange County. I grew up in Fullerton. I could see the Disney fireworks from my bedroom window at night, sometimes out in the distance. I had season pass at one point. I had the Disney Channel growing up. Like, we were definitely like a Disney family. So I'm really excited to have all of that crushed and ruined by this episode. No, in seriousness, this is a fun one. So Walt Disney, born in 1901, died in 1966. He won 26 Oscars, four of them kind of honorary special ones, so 22 like legit quote-unquote Oscars, most of anybody in history.
Does that include like, you know, his animator or, you know, Disney himself didn't win
I think
them.
He, it was Disney, Disney Studios. No, Disney himself won 22 Oscars. Because all the films and shorts and things he made that he was a producer on, he gets, you know, it's different than, of course, if an actor or something like that won, he wouldn't get credit for that. But he himself has the record for
I wonder if
Oscars.
That was like Elvis. Like, if he ever recorded a song, he demanded a songwriting credit even though he didn't write it.
Maybe, but he was the producer on everything. So if he won Best Animated Film and he was the producer on it, then he gets the Oscar. He gets to share it. Because he was heavily involved, even when he kind of turned the reins over to his creative staff as he turned his attention to other things. They said he was always in the story meetings and stuff. So he was always very hands-on with the direction of things.
Okay.
And I think people were like, he did, I mean, they did short subjects. They did some short documentary subjects on wildlife that won Oscars. Like, it was crazy, all the stuff that
Disney
did.
The Wonderful
did.
World of Disney.
And
that was a...
All this stuff.
That was Sunday nights. That was a thing. That was really wild. It was like before National Geographic. That was before cable. I mean, it was once, it was Channel 7 on Sunday nights for an hour. It was awesome.
I think the thing that just impresses me most about Disney was just that he was an innovator. He was if he wasn't the first to do it, he was among the first to do it, you know, of whatever thing they were doing, you know.
And he wasn't like Henry Ford or Thomas Edison, with like the people that really did it would mysteriously disappear.
No, he was like jumping in on it.
Yeah, I mean, he was legit.
You know, Steamboat Willie, some people say, is the first animated film with sound. That's not true. There was one a few weeks ahead of that that came out first, but that one was not popular. Steamboat Willie took off, and so he kind of gets... He was not the first, but he was among the first. He was one of the first to adapt the whole three-pane Technicolor process of animation. I mean, they were always like right at the... He was always pushing the boundaries and not like resting back on his laurels, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. So, and it paid off.
Definitely, my God.
So, how... You want to just jump ahead? His death to me is interesting, even though it was, you know, it was cancer. It wasn't it wasn't an exciting or scandalous death.
No, he smoked Lungbusters. You know, it was just
filterless cigarettes and pipes.
Lucky Stroke cigarettes, and he smoked a pipe. And he was, he wasn't the healthiest of individuals. You know, and so he contracted. He ultimately died of a heart attack or cardiac arrest, but it was due to, you know, decades of smoking.
And it was lung cancer.
It was lung cancer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he died quickly. I mean, he was diagnosed in November and was dead the next, few weeks later.
No, he'd been treated before.
Oh, really?
He was in the hospital for a month before he died. And
that's what I mean. I think it was like that month.
Yeah.
And when I read it, was he got diagnosed in November, immediately got into treatment, and it was way, way, way too late. He did like cobalt treatment or something like that. It was like an early form of radiation treatment, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
It was nice because it was really nice. A nice thing for them to have done is that, you know, he died at St. Joseph's Hospital in Burbank, and it's right across the street from Disney Studios, the film studio, not Disneyland. And during the time that he was in the hospital for that month, they gave him a room facing the studio. And moved his bed towards the window and left the lights on 24/7 so he could look out the window and see Disney Studios being lit up.
That's cool.
It was really kind of a cool thing to do.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. And then there's a really weird rumor about, the cryonics.
All the urban legends, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was frozen in his frozen body, frozen head is at Disneyland underneath his statue. I mean, there's just all these crazy...
I always heard that he was buried in a glass casket in a Snow White dress. but one thing that is sort of true. It's so weird.
That Snow White dress is true?
Yes. Oh. When he died... the name Kurt Russell came like written on a piece of paper for nobody knows why.
Oh, they think that when he was thinking of casting Kurt in something nobody or knows. Whatever, and he just wrote the name.
The word Kurt Russell, it's misspelled K-I-R-T, but yeah, just it was just there. Like one of the last things he ever did was write the word Kurt Russell on a piece of paper, and that's just true. It is true.
I've heard that too. Yeah, he and it may have just been he was in his mind. He was still working and developing something, and he had that idea.
Or maybe not. Maybe it was weird.
It was just weird.
It was weird, Mike.
Why do you got to come up with a rational explanation for everything? Can things just be weird? All right.
Disney had two daughters, and you know, part of the inspiration for Disneyland was the train in Griffith Park and the carousel in Griffith Park, and he saw these and he thought it'd be wonderful to create a place for all these sorts of things. So Diane, I think both daughters are dead now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know Diane, who was the head of the foundation for forever. She passed away a few years ago, and I don't the adopted daughter. I don't know.
Yeah, and remember they left all that money to make the Disney theater downtown, Disney Opera House. What is that even called? I don't know.
Disney Music Hall.
And he left all this money.
The famous Frank Gehry construction. Yeah,
but for years. You know, he left the money to have this thing built downtown, and all they built was the parking structure, and they ran out of money. It was sitting there. The Disney parking structure was sitting there for probably, it's not a joke, it was like 10 years before they got the money to build the actual place.
Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Yeah.
Just to be, so we don't get everybody correcting us. Walt Disney Concert Hall is what it was called, sorry.
And they had to, I remember they had to resurface it. It's that weird metal. You know,
it looks like sheet music or something. It was on that show, Engineering Disaster. Not Disaster, but like Miscalculations or whatever the show was called. But yeah. It's built across the street from some apartments. And it's a very famous design building by Frank Gehry, the architect.
It looks like sheet music.
It's like fluttering sheet music, but it's metallic colored. It's reflective. Yeah. And what happened was all these curves and weird angles. And what was happening was the sun on the southern facing side, the sun was bouncing off of it and frying these apartments across the street. These people's apartments were like 90 degrees when it was like, you know, it should have been like 70. And so they went out and figured out something, this film or something that they could put over that side of the building to dull it down so it wouldn't roast.
There was a place in London that like cars were melting, literally melting.
That's right. Because of the shard or one of those? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what it's called, the shard.
The shard.
But that's so funny. But anyway, Diane Miller, she was doing she would do these lectures at different universities about, you know, Disney in the studio. And then they would, or her father, at the end of it, they'd open up the Q&A. And the first thing before even anyone asked the question, she goes, "No, it's not true."
He wasn't frozen.
She said, "No, it's not true."
Can you imagine? That's like the thing you're getting asked the most.
If
by
his
people.
Head is frozen, yeah. Yeah. If anyone's head was going to be frozen, it would have been Disney's. Right. I think. But they, you know, he left.
Why?
Because he was so, you know, he never lived to see Epcot, which was his, you know, that was going to be his magnum opus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It just seemed like he was at the forefront of so much.
They never built the Epcot as he saw it as an actual community, which then Roy Disney afterwards, his brother, changed it to the Epcot Center.
What was the name of that city that they did make? Was it Freedom or something like that?
I can't remember.
It's up in California somewhere, Northern California. It's called Freedom USA or something. And it's all like white picket fences and stuff.
Nice. It's like Truman.
It's true.
It's Truman Show.
What, Celebration? Celebration Florida is the other one. Yeah.
Oh, right.
It was just
these
nice little, you know, as I say, Leave It to Beaver type of existence.
Well, that's what, like, Truman Show was filmed in an actual, I've been to it, I've stood in front of his house.
Yeah.
It's an actual neighborhood in the Panhandle. My uncle lives there in that area, and I drove over there to it. And it's a real place. It's like a planned.
It's
picturesque, so all-American type of a place.
That's right, and there was a murder in it really recently. No, but it was weird because it was like...
Did a light fall from the sky and hit somebody?
No, there was actually violence murder, and it was like the first time that this was going to happen because it was guaranteed your idyllic utopia to
really,
live here.
It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and Disney had a housekeeper, nanny. Her name was Thelma Howard, and she was with the Disney kids for decades, you know. And Disney, for Christmas and for her birthday, would always give her shares. You know, he said, whatever you do, just hang on to these things. Don't sell them. So when she died, it was like 1994 that she passed away, and her kids found this shoebox. And in it were 192,000 shares of Disney stock that she, you know, was worth something. At that point, it was worth, I think it was like $10 million or something. But now, I mean, it's just astronomical.
Now that they've acquired Marvel and everything, it's probably like $1 billion, yeah.
Yeah,
Star Wars. It's like when Disney passed away, he was, his estate was worth $20 million, which would be $160 million today.
Which is nothing.
Which is really not that much, but it hadn't fully. I mean, Disneyland was barely going at that point. It had been around like 11 years. He hadn't built Disney World yet. Obviously, you know, they hadn't had the animation renaissance of the '80s and nineties that came back, you know, and took Disney to another level. So, if he had lived, obviously his estate would have been worth a lot.
Oh my
more
god!
Than
I mean,
that.
The fact what do they give?
I think it's
Lucas?
Funny that we think $160 million. That's nothing.
Yeah. It is nothing anymore. But what did they pay? $20 billion for Star Wars from Lucas? I think it was $20 billion, and they made
four.
It back for in like a week.
I thought it was $4 billion.
Anyway, it was a lot of money.
It was many,
billions,
more billions than I can imagine.
It was billions. And here's interesting: when they bought Disney in 2012, they released The Last Jedi on his actual death anniversary, 51 years after he died. They released The Last Jedi,
the new trilogy of
yeah,
Star
the, after
Wars
they
films.
Acquired
yeah.
the Star Wars yeah. franchise. I mean, it was a nice tribute, I guess.
Yeah. You mentioned the Griffith Park merry-go-round and that stuff as being an inspiration. There was another story that came out a few years ago about his inspiration for Disneyland that I thought was really interesting, and I remembered it when we talked about doing this show. There was a very popular amusement park over on La Cienega where the Beverly Center now is called Beverly Park. And it was a year-round amusement park.
Uh-huh.
And it was owned by a guy named David Bradley. And what happened was it had been founded around, I think, 43 or 44. And then he bought it from the original founders a couple years later in 45.
Disney bought it?
No, this guy named David Bradley bought this amusement park in 1945 called Beverly Park on La Cienega. And so he was similar to Disney. He was an innovator. He was a bit of an eccentric guy. And he was obsessed with building a really great amusement park. And so Disney would his David Bradley, the guy that owned the park, his wife worked for Disney in the story department. She was a story researcher.
Huh.
And so David Bradley ends up meeting Disney through his wife. And Disney started bringing his two daughters, what he would call Daddy's Day, when he would take his daughters out.
That's right. They say a lot of Daddy's divorced Day. Guys would bring, yeah, when yeah. they got their kids, they would take
they
them
They would
there,
go to Beverly Park. Yeah, I love this. It was, yeah. And so Disney would take his two daughters to the Beverly Park, and he would quiz the kids as they would come off the rides, because Disney had been thinking even since the 30s about doing a big amusement park. Mm-hmm. And so he would ask the kids, oh, what did you like about that ride? And it was like research for him. When he decided to make Disneyland, he ended up hiring David Bradley as a consultant for Disneyland.
That's interesting.
It was supposedly David Bradley's idea to make Main Street 7/8 scale. Another thing that Disney loved was the Beverly Park was very clean, and Disney wanted Disneyland to be a very clean park because a lot of
physically clean.
He was kind of disgusted by a lot of the amusement parks they went to were just dirty and trash was everywhere. You know, he didn't want that. And David Bradley even traveled to Europe on his behalf and photographed and researched other theme parks that were in Europe, and I think some other people on the staff, it wasn't just him, went over there and studied. It kind of went all over the world to get the best ideas and put them all into Disneyland. So I thought that was a cool LA connection.
Yeah, you know? I mean, and it makes sense too, because their big thing was like horseback riding and stuff, and the original Disney stuff was like canoes and horses and stagecoaches and things like that. It wasn't, you know, Space Mountain wasn't a thing yet.
And Beverly Park next door to it was a thing called Ponyland. It was a different owner, but it was a woman who brought a bunch of ponies down, and your kids could ride the ponies. And normally, when parents came to Beverly Park, they'd go to both parks, because it was kind of a connected thing, even though they were different owners.
Yeah.
So, they had the pony rides and that.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Disney was certainly an innovator, most definitely. And rest in peace, Uncle Walt. I love that, you know, the Mickey Mouse Club, all those guys always called him Uncle Walt.
Yeah.
No, actually, I think it was Annette Annette Funicello, who is just, you know, I just adore. She was just the sweetest Mouseketeer with the...
She's like the most famous of the Mouseketeers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
He was the one, when he disbanded the Mickey Mouse Club, she was the only one that he kept.
Uh-huh.
And he always said, he asked the kids to call him Uncle Walt, and she couldn't do it. She always called him Mr. Disney, which is, that was kind of neat. But it's interesting, because a lot of those people, like the, you know, Cubby O'Brien, you know, he went on to be a pretty famous drummer for the Carpenters and a lot of other people. And then Darlene was a shoplifter, and you know, Bobby Driscoll was, you know, a junkie, and unless he's alive, and I got the wrong. But no, but I mean, there have been lots of Disney deaths. You know, a lot of rumors about Disney. They said he was a Nazi. They said he was a racist. They said he was
all disputed and contested, of course.
Which is interesting because they, you know, Song of the South was out there. You know, Song of the South is pretty hardcore.
Pretty much Disney won't even acknowledge that that movie
exists. No, they won't
anymore. You can't
killed.
Get it. It's a bad stereotype.
But stereotypes exist for a reason.
Yeah.
And I'm not justifying it as, they didn't do anything that wasn't historically correct in a lot of degrees.
What they would do is they would do cultural appropriation, and sometimes they just got it very wrong.
Well, things existed. It's just when you portray them, they become a focal point, and it becomes...
And that was even...
As a gay person, I dealt with that all of my life. You know, you hear, oh, Mary,
well,
you know?
When you walked in today, I was watching Three's Company, which I just got on box set.
Yeah.
The entire premise for that show is essentially homophobia.
Yeah.
It's Jack pretends to be gay so that he's allowed to room with two women. And the manager that lives downstairs, the Ropers, will let him live there. And Mr. Roper is super homophobic.
Oh, he's always like swishing and putting...
Every joke between him and Jack is something to do with, gay related. And anytime Jack touches him, he jumps away. You know what I mean? It's kind of uncomfortable. I guess maybe, but again, I think that goes to social norms. In the 70s, it was probably somewhat forward or progressive, I guess, to have a character even pretending to be gay that was the star of a show.
Yeah,
I guess.
I mean, it was the gay liberation movement started in 1969 with the funeral of Judy Garland. I mean, that's just the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the riot at Stonewall Inn in New York. But every minority, I guess, has been victim to some sort of stereotype. And Song of the South is pretty rough. It was 50s. The backlash wasn't until the 80s.
Yeah, sure.
So it's like everything that's going on today, you know, without getting into any of that. But I know that Disney really pushed that Jack Basket did get an honorary Academy Award in 1948. So Disney, you know, I don't think he was a racist. I don't think he was racist as things were back then, I guess. But, you know, everyone...
I don't think he was, no.
Not an official kind of, we're going to put on a pointy hat thing.
I did a lot of reading because the main thing about the anti-Semitism was not a single person, even his biggest critics, guys that he worked for him that hated him, that had, you know, been fired or whatever, that were his biggest rivals. Even they said they never heard him say or do anything anti-Semitic. It was more the company he kept in some circles. And what happened was... he became more and more anti-labor as his company grew, and there was the big animator strike in 1941, and so he became very politically anti-labor, anti-communist, and I think what happens is when you do that and you start going to meetings with people that are anti-labor and anti-communist, that the Venn diagram somewhat intersects with people that are also anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
Not that all people
mm-hmm.
that are anti-labor are anti-Semitic, but it's the same side of the political spectrum, and so he ended up putting himself in the company of some guys who were anti-labor and also didn't like Jewish people. So, and I think that's where that wasn't the reason he was there. He was there for business reasons. He didn't want labor unions and stuff to form. And
they're very
in the way of his business. What Disney, he thought his vision was for his business. Yeah.
Disney is very well known for being, putting on a great show at the expense of its cast members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he will, which actually segues perfectly into what we're going to be talking about in just a moment, how people, they're litigious.
Mm-hmm.
Remember there was that school that was using Winnie the Pooh stationery and Disney shot him down, even though I think Disney, I think Winnie the Pooh is the only project that Disney ever did that wasn't written by specifically for Disney.
Do
believe that Winnie the Pooh is the only thing that he did not own, and that's a real problem for Disney because the people, A.A. Milne, I think it was the guy who actually wrote it, never turned over the rights. The guy that did Peter Pan, he turned over the rights to Peter Pan for the St. Norman Street Hospital in London.
And the most famous example of that probably is Mary Poppins. and P.L. Travers, which brings me to one more thing I really wanted to bring up, which there's a documentary called The Boys about the Sherman Brothers. I highly recommend it. It came out about a decade ago. I think it came out in 2009.
Yeah.
The Sherman Brothers were his writing team, his music writing team. They wrote all the great classic Disney songs of the 50s and 60s.
And Small World.
Winnie
and
the
everything.
Pooh song was theirs. And all the songs on Mary Poppins were theirs. And he called them the boys.
Yeah.
Hey, bring the boys over here. And then when that film came out, Saving Mr. Banks, which was with Tom Hanks playing Walt Disney, that was about that whole, the making of Mary Poppins. They're played by B.J. Novak and Jason Schwartzman play the Sherman Brothers, their characters in the movie. And it's the boys, it's a really great one. It was made by the two sons of the Sherman Brothers. And the craziest thing about the story was the Sherman Brothers, they were brothers, obviously. They were writing partners. They worked all the time together, every day. And yet they never saw each other socially outside of work. Their families barely even knew each other. I think they even lived in the same neighborhood. And the cousins, the kids of the families, never played together. The brothers socially didn't like each other. Their personalities were so opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had a good working relationship, but it's a very odd story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is just the older brother went to World War II and was badly injured and had a limp for his life. And I think he liberated one of the death camps and saw some horrible things. And he came back with a much darker side than his kind of younger brother, who was this happy-go-lucky, positive guy. And I think because of that, maybe, was the reason that they just couldn't
personally. They probably all got co-writing credit, but I imagine things like Zippity-Doo-Dah was done by one, and the other one about the crazy lady that hangs out in front of St. Paul's Cathedral was the other one.
I think one guy would sit at the table, he would sit at the piano and pound out a melody, and the other guy would think up the lyrics to go with it, which a lot of songwriting duos, that's kind of how they would do things. So,
there was one other thing about the boys
documentary is so good.
About Walt Disney is that he did not. A lot of people think that he lived in the La Bianca house,
I wanted to talk about this. Yeah,
and he did.
Which the La Bianca were the couple that were murdered by the Mansons the day after.
Right, the Tate murders.
So
Disney and Roy Disney bought two other houses in Los Feliz, next door to each other, and that particular house was the house that the La Biancas used to live in before Mr. LaBianca, Lino LaBianca's mother died, and he moved into the house where the murders happened. So it was the house they lived in before the one they were murdered in that used to belong to Walt Disney.
So that's what has led people to think that he was killed in Walt Disney's former home.
Right.
But they weren't. Yes.
Yeah.
They just once lived there and were killed at their house.
Yeah. At a different house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're just knocking down urban legends left and right here today.
It's our lot in life. It's our cross to bear.
All right. Well, let's talk Disneyland, and let's introduce our special guest, Scott. Your niece.
My niece.
Worked as a, not just at Disney World, but worked as a character.
She went straight in.
To me, is like the Holy Grail, and the best one.
I know. She went straight into that. I mean, that was a crazy thing. I mean, right into the main character.
Yes.
Not someone that held a bit of Cinderella's dress or something like that as she was walking by. It wasn't like
she
that. I mean, straight into the main attraction. I think that's like so cool.
Yeah. So let's bring her in.
Yeah, first of all, as much as I love how all of that sounds, starting off as the mouse, which is who I started off as.
You started out not just the mouse, Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse, yes. The boss, as he is fondly called over there. I was actually in Disney World in Florida, not California. But that's all based completely 110% on your height and what you do once you're placed in a height range, like, say, either meet and greets, which, taking photos with the guests, or parades, that can vary, like, on your dance ability and stuff like that. So it's not necessarily, like, a huge promotion. It's, first of all, like, if you're 4'10 to 5'1", maybe, like, you're going to be the mouse. Like, you're going to be
Mickey. When you walk in there, I mean, I imagine that's got to be, like, the dream character for a lot of people. Because a lot of people that work at Disney are Disney freaks.
Oh, yeah. You have a lot of their hearts.
You got to be Mickey and you just got here?
Yeah, I mean, a tiny bit. The jealousy comes into play, I think, once you start to learn or not learn certain shows and parades. That can start to spark a little more jealousy in people. So you don't all like get to be in the Main Street Parade.
So different people play Mickey at different parts of the park.
So
basically,
like pretty much any live production, there's an audition and there's a
dance. How did that go?
Well, I had
Do you get in the suit?
No. Not at first. So for me, that was a dance audition, which was fine for me because I had a big dance background. And then there was also an animation audition. So that's where they have you pantomime a situation. So one of the classic ones they have you a pantomime is to pick a character, any Disney character, your favorite one, and then have them be at a day at the beach. So that's what you have to pantomime, and you're given, I don't know, they play music and they give you like 8-8 counts to just go nuts. And while all of this is going on, they're also checking out people for face character lookalikes, like the characters that don't wear masks, your princes,
like
your princess, Wendy, Alice, Peter Pan. And if they like you for one of those, then they'll pull you aside, and no matter like what state the audition's in, they'll have a couple wigs or a couple costumes to have you try on.
A lot of them or most of them actors?
It really varies. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I found out about this because I was pursuing theater, and that was the direction I was wanting to go anyway.
Right.
But, I mean, those people tend to excel, but they are in such need of people who are lookalikes that you don't even have to have much dance experience to get pulled. If you look like that character, they're going to want you really bad. There's certain height ranges, like that 5-foot height range, that's rare to find people who are that height and who have like decent, you know, animation ability that they'll take. And plus they need so many more mouse, just like mice throughout the parks. There's just so many more Mickeys and Minnies around that they just need the quantities more. And the same thing goes for the upper end of the range with like Goofy and like those very tall characters.
Oh, you mean tall upper.
Yeah, like the tall end of the range. So those are much more in demand than the ones that are in the middle, like Pluto's.
Yeah.
Within that community, like they're called like the dead height because there's less for them to do, and there's so many more people who are in that height range because it's an average.
So there's
height.
More competition to get a part.
Yeah,
if you're that
yeah. So they can
range,
be
yeah.
pickier with their Pluto's.
Sure.
So like within my height range, I had a whole list of characters who, just on paper, my height was in that range. I never played most of them. There were all kinds of costumes, and a few autographs I learned, I never even saw the costume.
They train you because the characters actually do sign autographs, so they train you how to do that character's autograph.
Oh, yeah, that's part, like, in order for you to even be allowed out into the park, you do have to pass an autograph test.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you do it with the gloves on?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How?
They have you practice with oven mitts.
Oh,
before they put you in the costume.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, like, when that's, you know, there's like a, at least when I did, there was like a 5-day training period. I think it was 5-day. And then day 5 was your first day out in the park. And, but those other few days, you're just practicing in costumes and, you know, rehearsal spaces. And, but on those days when you're just still really just learning those autographs, they have you. They say, go home and practice with your oven mitts.
So now at Disneyland, Mickey is like a ride, basically. You don't see Mickey just walking around. He's in like the Toon Land or whatever it is. It's over kind of down
scheduled,
near where the...
like meet and greets
you have to go and stand. You have to stand in a line just like a ride. It goes into a building. And then when it's time, you go into this room and he's standing there waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you go in with a small group of people, like maybe a dozen people at a time or whatever, and you do the pictures with him and whatever and hang out with him, and then they usher you out the door and another group comes in. I think when I was a kid, he was just walking around. But
oh,
I think it's
yeah,
just so, no. I think Disneyland has gotten so crowded and busy now that they just can't, he just probably gets mobbed and it turns into a mess, right?
It's a mess.
So even when you were there, did you walk around as Mickey or?
Hardly ever. Mm-hmm. So the only time I remember ever roaming, that's what you would call roaming, is when I would be scheduled to do Fantasmic. So this would be at the Hollywood Studios Park. And in order to give the performers during the show that night like a full day of hours, they would have something we called PM sets. And that's just where you're called in like however 2-3 hours before your actual show shift, and you just go do sets in the park, and that's just kind of like an extra magical moment for the people. Mm. A lot of times they would choose a few like random characters you don't get to see, like Max from a Goofy movie. He was popular. And for a while, we would just kind of, we would stick to, like, the streets of America is what they would call it. It's, like, mm-hmm. those little, like, New York City streets. And we kind of just, like, roam around. And there would be attendants, like, multiple attendants with us, just making sure nothing got too crazy.
To get crowd control and everything, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not, it wouldn't be scheduled. It would just be something, like, if there were guests in that area and they happened to get this whole dump of characters on them. And it was really cool. Like, it was just, like, one of those things that made people so happy. And, like, the, it was no, like, it wasn't, like, a strict line situation. In fact, they encouraged the performers, like, keep moving once you take your photos with one group. Keep moving. Don't let a line form. Because the whole point was for it to be, like, you know, just casual.
Magical.
Right. But then people started, like, this uber Disney fan started to get, like, hip to this, and they started to, whether it was just
people that have season passes, they just started to figure out.
Yeah, they were actually starting to post times of when these things would happen. And then for a while they were having to switch locations of where the characters would come out, because people would be waiting for them, because it's cool, like a whole big group of characters.
So there was an article a few years ago that I saw that was really interesting, where it was a guy, he had played Jack Sparrow at mm-hmm. Disneyland. Jack Sparrow from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, the Johnny Depp character. And he said that he had a strict kind of training regimen that he went through to become the character, and he had a lot of experience. I think he'd done Renaissance fairs before then, and I think he kind of warned them. He's like, this character is going to be really popular when we do this. And it was interesting because he was told not to flirt with women because Jack Sparrow's character is suspicious of women, but he was supposed to be somewhat of a rule breaker too. He's supposed to be kind of mischievous. You know, that's how Jack Sparrow is. And apparently, there were kind of these regular women that would come to the park, you know, ostensibly with their kids as their excuse, and they would get in the line to see him, and they would keep going through the line and through the line and through the line, and he would start noticing the same women that had, like, season passes would always be there for him. Like, he almost got, like, groupies, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, it was like a sex guy.
It was like
people,
it was like a thing. Yeah, yeah, these women got
probably
kind of
a fantasy.
Did
yeah.
anything? I mean, I'm sure that didn't happen with Mickey, but did that happen with any of the other characters that you ever heard of?
I remember that happening with Peter Pan a lot.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's the tights.
Yeah, yeah, and like girls in like their upper teens, 20s, they like were all about Peter Pan. Like, there's that pixie thing going on. I don't know, but there would
it's
be
just so androgynous,
a lot of
really,
repeat.
Wasn't he?
Yeah, I guess. Like, that was kind of the thing. He's like the boy that didn't grow up, so that was the whole deal. It was a very asexual kind of thing. But, yeah, no, I did hear stories about, like, Uber fans coming through to see Pan, and really any of the face characters.
I'm sure if the men are having that issue, the female characters, the princess characters, are probably having their own issues.
I mean,
occasionally with, you would think.
Much different story, but, yeah, I mean, not that I know of anything in particular. Definitely as Minnie Mouse. It would happen, not constantly, but there would still be comments, which is just
what are they
joking
saying?
Around.
I don't
stuff?
Remember.
Is it kind of like a lot of it just joking around? So like, hey, Minnie, how you doing? Like,
right,
when you get off
like
work,
a lot of like pretending to come and steal you away from Mickey, and I mean, it didn't get too gross, but just the fact that like the joke was being made was kind of gross.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a story yet about, was it Skywalker?
Oh, yeah. So I'm not going to say her first name, but there was, during Star Wars weekends, there was a super fan of Luke Skywalker who would be there every day, every weekend of the event, and she did legally change her name, last name, to Skywalker. And, I mean, she was well-loved between all of the Star
yeah.
Wars people, but, like, you know, that's people take their fandom to a huge
mm-hmm.
degree.
So how do they train you to be Mickey? Like, what mannerisms would they tell you to do? Like, how do you act like a cartoon character, I guess?
There's a few signature poses. He has his foot pop. He has his lapel. He has his lapel, like, where he holds onto his jacket.
Right.
Hands on the hips is a big one. So, and then either arm up, like, a ta-da kind of pose, or out to the side. So there's a lot of signature poses that they'll start with. But mostly, they put you in a head, and then they have you kind of do, like, a catwalk. That was what our training was for. They just put on some music, and they're like, all right, just walk around like a boy. Just start doing it, like,
how
just to get
walk?
Used to, like, just, you know, not dainty like yeah. a girl. Like, you're more planted into the ground versus on your toes, and
mm-hmm.
I think they literally played Cover Girl for part of this, like
the
just
RuPaul
to get it,
song.
Yeah, yeah, and just like to get us out of our heads, having fun, because you know, then even because if you're a boy, there's some short boys out there who came in and they have to do all the mice too, and there'll be Minnie Mouse as well, so they got to work on being a girl. So, but yeah, they make it fun.
For some people, it came natural.
For some people, it did come natural. So, yeah, and some of them have much nicer legs than the actual girls. That silhouette is, you get to see all Minnie's legs. Those are tights.
Oh, of course. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes complete... Yeah. Now, those heads were not...
You want a guy who skipped leg day, basically,
yeah,
to play
yeah.
Minnie. Yeah.
No, they were usually pretty nice.
They're not air-conditioned or anything, are they?
No.
You would think that after how
and
many decades
Florida.
They would be.
That is my top question I get.
Yeah,
Where are there fans inside the heads?
I mean, you're in Orlando in August.
Oh, yeah.
How?
You just find out what you're made of really fast. During training, you lose about 10 pounds.
You must.
And
they got to clean it?
Oh yeah. I mean, like they're good about that. They're not gross at all. You get your costume for the day and you get your what they call basics underneath, which are just shorts and t-shirts, cotton shorts, like Fruit of the Loom, literally just the most basic things, and that's what goes underneath the costume, and you can check out as many shorts and t-shirts as you need, as many socks as you need to switch out throughout the day. And then once your costume's done, once you go home for your shift, you turn it back in, and that's all sent out and bleached and sanitized and ready for the next people.
I bet you like it in like armored cars or something. You take them off. No, I'm sure they have their own laundromat within the premises.
Oh
sure.
Yeah,
they
for
have
sure.
Everything.
They can do quite a bit on property, like well in like right inside the park costuming, but then some of it sent out.
I want to know when you did the when you were doing, because you would do like acrobatic stuff, you would do stuff where you had to be harnessed in, and it's Fantasmic, and I really really wanted to see you do Fantasmic, and I never got a chance, but you were Mickey in Fantasmic on the elevator at the end of it with fireworks coming out of your fingertips.
Okay, so yes and no. That Mickey on top of the mountain does not have fireworks in his fingertips. The Mickey on the stage below the mountain has the fireworks in his fingertips, which I did not get to do. Still bummed about that, but I did get to be on top of the mountain, and that was amazing.
Wow.
So I would have to climb all the way to the top, and I would check out a harness in, like, costuming back in, like, the green room. Halfway up the mountain, a tech would come and check that everything was buckled in properly, and then I'd get to the top, and I'd wait for time to come, and then I would hop onto this little, like, hydraulic platform. They'd buckle me to the back, and there's just, like, kind of this post I'm leaning against. A very strong post, not, like, a wimpy thing. And, yeah, they would hook me in twice. There was two different metal carabiner harnesses I was hooked into. So that all grabbed into, the ring that kind of came out from my harness. So I was very well secure. And that thing, once on the music cue, it just pops up. You do your choreography, and then it drops you down. But that's about as dangerous as it got. So there was nothing acrobatic, as cool as it sounds.
But there was an element of danger. You could be harnessed
in. Yeah. I had to have my own safety rehearsal for that. And I can't remember if I was paid a premium for that. But there are certain roles that are paid a safety premium for slightly more dangerous things.
Fantasmic is like nothing else. I mean, it's got every character at some point in time. Now, so you would do this, and then you'd run over and change a costume and do that,
yeah.
And then you'd do that. And how many characters through a show would you do?
I think there's like 48 is the number of cast members in that show, of just people who come on and off stage. So that Sorcerer Mickey, that's not even 30 seconds of time that you're up there. So there's lots of other things to do throughout the show. So I would start off the show, there's a scene, like a jungle scene with black lights, and it features Rafiki on these little like boats that come through in the water, but on stage there were these wooden animal puppets. So yeah, for that scene I was part of a cheetah, so there's like these like flat wooden cheetahs that were glowed in the black lights, and you would operate their legs to make them look like they're running. And then I would go and do, there was a Pocahontas scene, and for that, if I was doing Sorcerer Mickey, I was an Indian by the campfire, and we had some choreography with spears. I also played Pinocchio on the boat, and I also played Minnie Mouse on the boat.
In one production, how many? What would be the maximum amount of roles that you'd play in one show of Fantasmic?
Four.
So this guy that played played the Jack Sparrow character, yeah. He did kind of a tell-all. He was let go eventually, and he kind of complained that there was very strict rules for how the characters are allowed to act. And he was in he claimed he was between a rock and a hard place because he had to abide by the rules, but also he was playing a very mischievous character, so he's kind of supposed to be a rule breaker. So it was very hard for him to find that balance between being the character and not pissing off, you know, breaking the rules. And I think, Scott, you said that that guy eventually went on and was Jack Sparrow in front of the Chinese theater for a while for the tourists, which he was really good.
He was really good at it.
Might have made more money from the tourists.
He sounds really good.
What was the code of conduct? Like, how would you...
I mean, it did feel at certain times like you could step into a booby trap at any moment.
Right, because you're dealing with unpredictable situations with the public, people, and kids could do something weird, and who knows, right?
It was made very clear that if you were ever in an uncomfortable situation, that you talk to get the attention of your attendant.
Was there like a signal or something?
There was a distress signal for something was actually going wrong or like you needed to be taken off set, and it's you cover one eye and then you raise your hand. I think they've since changed that because that just looks like a distress signal. Like, what is Mickey doing?
Clench your chest and fall.
Oh my God, is Mickey having a stroke? What is happening?
I know at certain points during like shows or parades, you crossed your arms if you needed help. Mm-hmm. So, which is slightly less, you know, obvious, but
not just wave your hands in the air. That's probably what I would do.
Yeah, you don't want to, because honestly, that could just be part of your animation at some point.
What is like can you think of like the weirdest interaction you ever had with like a little kid or anything like that?
I'm trying to think of like, I remember meeting an infant baby named Anakin that stands out. Yeah, that was.
It was at that Skywalker Girls kid?
No. Younger parents. Man, I've had hands creep up into my head before. that would be more as a mouse. Those are a little bit... They've since edited the costumes a little bit where it's a lot harder to do that now.
That means it happens so often that they had to make a costume design change.
Yeah, and that's how so many things happen there. It's very reactionary.
Yeah, something weird keeps happening.
Oh,
like, okay,
yeah,
let's
it's
fix
with
it.
Anything. You know, it's always in retrospect.
How can you predict what people are going to do? It's impossible, right?
Well, that's where, like, one of those things I was telling you about that happened during the show. We had a performer. This is on the stage in front of Cinderella's castle where a performer's knee popped out on stage. And this was...
Like an injury?
Like, this kneecap was in the back of his leg.
Ow!
And this happened on stage?
And
or was
this
he...
is...
Okay, and which character was he?
He was performing Goofy.
Oh, no.
Goofy's down. So...
What symbol did he make to let him know he was in trouble?
He was not... He was not worried at that point about making any signals. He was just sitting there trying to figure out what the hell to do. So in this show, I was right next to him. And this moment, the two of us are the only ones on this platform. Oh, we do, like, I remember this so specifically, is the final part of the choreography is a spin into a pose. It was literally the finale of the show.
So he spun his knee out, basically.
We do, like, our like, where we see each other, I spin, and I don't see him anymore. And I'm like, I see him sitting on the stairs up to the platform, and I'm like, because, like, you know, after a while or a long day or whatever, you're still goofing around on stage. Like, you know, some people like to take it too far. I'm like, what is he doing? But then I see him kind of just, like, lurch forward, and I'm like, oh, he's not okay. And this is literally the end of the show, and as the exits, everyone's doing their bows. The dancers, like the people who are physically capable of doing anything to help him, have already gone off stage.
Oh, no.
And Donald Duck can't just hoist Goofy up. and I could tell. He wasn't saying, like, he said something. I can't remember what he said to me. But I'm like, there's no way he was even going to be, even if I could support him. There was no way I was walking him off stage, and there's no way that would have looked.
He needed a stretcher.
Like. Right, exactly. There was no way that would have looked.
And could they close a curtain?
No. So this is a completely exposed stage in front of the castle. Like, there's nowhere for him to go. And this is one of those situations where there's no policy in place until after it happens.
That's wild.
So what happens is I, looking like kind of a tool, because Goofy and Donald are supposed to bow together and then exit. So I go, I wave, I don't bow, and I leave. And I'm like,
You left him out there.
Yeah, well, yeah. There was literally nothing I could do. Because it would have looked worse for me to try and help him up and see him limp off stage if he could have even managed that. So I'm like, someone needs to go get Goofy. And so finally people start to figure out what's going on.
In the audience.
No, well, I mean, yeah, I'm sure people eventually.
Why is Goofy?
Yeah, like, what's he doing?
And writhing and being
at this point, he's like trying to stay, literally keep himself from passing out.
Right.
Like, not like waving while he's sitting there trying to be like, oh, it's okay.
He's having a medical emergency.
He's just focusing on not passing out and like whatever.
God, that's crazy.
So the only thing that could happen is the dancers come back on stage, they're figuring out what's going on. And meanwhile, you know, everyone's throwing out a wave, like, hey, this is, you know, we're just hanging out or whatever. And then, when a costume is transported from one part of the park to another, they're black bagged. So it's these giant canvas bags that you kind of hoist over your shoulder like Santa. And so they start bringing out black bags, and each dancer is holding one up to kind of start to create a screen. And there's literally, like, a black bag surrounding what's happening, and then by now we've got paramedics there. And those are what, that's what.
I mean, there must be some sort of.
Did they clear people out of the audience, or is there
no
nothing
way
you could do?
It's
people
literally, just saying, it's just in the park.
So people were just watching
it.
Do
you think they improvised, or do you think it was something that, say, if this situation comes up, because they probably have
that was,
to.
It was like, I know for a fact that they were just doing this on the
cover
fly.
Cover it up, yeah.
So they were like, we need to cover him up so the paramedics can find out what exactly happened. Get him out of his costume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, like, the first thing was he needed to get out of his head.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
He needed to get out of his head because, like, you know, he needs to breathe better than, you know, just because he's injured. Anyway, so I'm figuring out what happened next. Eventually, they did get a stretcher on stage. Mm. I think they had to conceal it.
I was
going to
say, a little kid would be scarred for life. Goofy get taken off on a stretcher.
Yeah, they needed to get him out of his costume before he went on the stretcher. But meanwhile, there's this whole other show, like it's like a parade, but it's called Street Party, that comes through. So they held that show, and meanwhile, with like the paramedics rushing on and off stage, the dancers hanging out there with black bags, who eventually their arms get tired. Like there needed to be another solution, so they think they brought a costume screen and rolled that out on stage.
That makes more sense, yeah.
But eventually, they did let that other show go, and they came out. Goofy's in there; he's doing fine. He's having a party on this parade floor.
Forget about that other Goofy that just blew his knee out on stage and is getting taken to the hospital.
It looked so bleak on there. It looked pretty tragic, and the next show was canceled for sure. But that performer had a rough hour there, but he posted on Facebook when he got to the hospital, so he was okay. They popped his knee back in.
Well, then they put a bunch of
Vicodin
in his system, and
hopefully.
He was fine. He was in
a
good place by then.
Vicodin.
I'm sure they gave him something good, yeah.
Because they
shot.
There's
little mouse
he
ears
got
on
it.
It.
He got it. He did.
Not that kind of Vicodin.
He did get a shot while he was on stage.
I would
I know
imagine.
That our stage manager.
Yeah, I would.
Was mama bearing him, like making sure he
be like morphine right
needed.
Now?
Yeah, they have their own paramedics. It wasn't like they called off, you know, an ambulance came
and had to come
to
the park.
Hospital,
right?
They not in their own hospital. They have like a wellness center where they can do a lot. Mm-hmm. But
it was 19. I think it was 98 that there was a guy. It was Christmas Eve that was when the boat was going by the Columbia, and these ropes and they tied it to one of the metal cleats. And this, you know, the cast member tied it to this cleat, and the boat didn't stop,
and
it was
the
wrong rope,
broke
and
off.
It flew out into the crowd and hit this guy in the head on Christmas Eve, in front of his kids and killed him. And that Disney had a payout. You know, Disney's really, there's no...
Well, yeah. We would be remorse. We're dearly departed if we don't talk about people that have died at Disneyland.
Has anyone ever died while you were there? And people that die all the time in these parks.
All that example there was the only example in Disneyland's history where somebody died where it was not their fault in some way.
Right.
Where it was
a piece of equipment failed. Yeah.
Everybody else has died at Disneyland. It was most likely they climbed over a fence and went to a restricted area or climbed up on the monorail and got hit by the monorail. I mean, you know, dumb shit where people were doing things they weren't supposed to
drowning.
Do. Usually kids there on graduation, the special graduation night parties that they do, and kids show up and they drink and they do things like try to swim across to Tom Sawyer Island and they die.
It was pretty stupid stuff that usually happens there. And then people probably have heart attacks all the time in the park. So I would imagine.
That's the one that happened while I was there. A man had some sort of heart issue while on Expedition Everest in Animal Kingdom. And the ride photo, the way I remember it, in the ride photo, he appeared conscious. And then maybe a minute later, they roll back into the station and he wasn't.
Wow.
So... He did die, whether or not, I mean, I assume personally that it happened, like, instantly.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not pronounced dead until he was at the hospital. Mm-hmm.
And they watch, like, there's security people watching every stretch of a ride. I think somebody in my car kind of splashed a little bit, but nothing malicious or anything. But immediately a guy came over to speak and was like, don't splash.
Yeah.
And we're like, whoa, even though it feels dark in here, somebody's looking at us. On a security monitor to make sure we're not stupid.
And any ride, because like with ones like the popular ones like Haunted Mansion, that's really popular for people to come scatter ashes on the ride.
Oh, yeah,
they're like
yeah.
loved ones' ashes.
We talked about this a little last week, I think,
constantly,
didn't we? 2 weeks ago.
They're
that's
constantly monitoring because they need to immediately stop the ride. Evacuate it and clean it before
you
can they
have
can
have human remains.
Yeah.
Well, no, they don't. They could be anthrax. So they don't know what the hell these people
are
doing.
Too.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You assume it's remains, but it may not be. You're right. Yeah.
So yeah, that has to be immediately dealt with. So if you're thinking of doing that, your friend or your family member, one, you'll get caught, and two, they're going to end up in a trash can.
Yeah, they're going to vacuum your family member.
It's symbolic, though. I think because people do that in front of the fountains in front of the
Bellagio.
Yeah, a lot of people
get
scared into that, and they just end up in a filter. So it is just symbolic. but I mean, as far as...
You put your loved one in a pool filter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's symbolic solely. I mean,
right.
It is just ash or cremains, but...
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that... Like, if I were to do it, if I was even interested in doing that, I would use the cemetery outside the Haunted Mansion. You know, and then you're just standing in line
right.
and just throw it
just
over
throw
your
it
shoulder
into a
and
bush
be done
and
with
there it.
It
is.
Yeah,
you're actually
like,
in a cemetery.
Kind of like be subtle about it
if
it's going to happen.
Just, we're giving you advice for how to spread cremains.
And
you
have
mansion.
To, like, jeopardize everyone else's good time because of your selfish gesture.
Don't be dumb. I guess just know that you are being monitored and you're not. It's not going to be easy to get away with it if you do attempt such a thing.
For sure.
I mean, if you put a little bit in your hands, just go poof. And then, you know, it would fly, you know,
sure.
just those teaspoons.
Or look like you're taking lint out of your pocket
yeah,
and just going
to drop
it out
it.
On
be
the ground.
Be classy, not a whole bucket. My
yeah,
God.
Be classy. Come
yeah,
on.
Like
don't
2 pounds
bring
of cremains.
Grandma's full urn
no.
in a tote bag
it's
and just dump
gesture.
It.
It's a symbolic gesture.
Yeah.
I took some of my friend Larry over to Ella Fitzgerald's grave and just went into the crack of the grave because now he's part of him as it all is. Most of it's on the floor, but it doesn't really matter. That
he,
was a really
he
sweet thing
mind.
To do. I don't think so.
He wouldn't.
It's symbolic. It's for the people. Well, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. There's a rumor that I've always heard about on Disney cruise ships that they have in lifeboats, they put a Mickey character in a lifeboat. And if the ship ever goes down, whoever's in the lifeboat will be there with a Mickey. So when they get on the island or wherever they're going to land, Mickey will be there and he wouldn't have gone down with the ship. I mean, it sounds... I love that story.
Yeah, as far as I know, that is still just a rumor. I feel like because that hasn't happened yet, they haven't decided what they'll do yet. But I do have a friend who works in character costuming on a boat, a Disney boat right now, and they haven't been trained for anything like that. There's plenty of things safety-wise that they are trained for in an emergency, like literal procedures that they'll have to do to
in character
No. It is all...
It's like Tinkerbell. Follow me!
Don't forget to keep waving.
But it's strictly as themselves, as human people, keeping themselves safe and guests safe. And but yeah, there was another rumor that they have to do something to the character heads so that they don't bob up and reach the surface of the water for people to see.
Oh my god.
And that is also as far as I know a rumor. But yeah.
So their heads are supposed to sink.
The rumor is that when this emergency is taking place, that the costumers need to do something to the heads to weight them so that they'll sink. But the reality is,
imagine the seven heads bobbing.
Imagine you would just never forget that image.
No.
The different sections of the ship, like backstage where these things take place anyway, are airtight and sealed, so I don't think that's an issue anyway. They'll just be trapped.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Trapped inside the ship.
Disney's probably pretty well versed in safety issues and saving face. I mean, isn't that it? Isn't that what Disney does? Like, yeah. 100 and 200 percent of the time is just making sure that their brand is protected.
Intact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when we were, because it's pretty famous in the parks that they have what they call hidden Mickeys all over the place.
Oh,
they're hidden in topiary and in fences and fence posts and all sorts of things, right?
Yes. It's definitely something Imagineers would do, but people took it to this extreme level where there's unauthorized books that are published about all the places you can find them. The official statement from Disney on the subject of hidden Mickeys is, if you think it's a hidden Mickey, it's a hidden Mickey.
Okay.
Basically, it's use your imagination, and if you're having fun looking for them, go crazy. There's a couple, there's one that's supposed to be on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride where, in the part where there's a donkey peeking out of a barn, when he turns his head, the silhouette, the shadow that casts on the barn door is supposed to be a Mickey, and I never could make a Mickey out, so there's some that are pretty obvious, and then there's others that you gotta hunt down, but people, really take it to an extreme degree where, they think there's one everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we went to, about 6 or 8 months ago, we had the opportunity to go to Club 33, which Disney people, that I know, were like, you what?
Yeah.
You
know, I've never been, and I've been going to Disney.
It's really the holy grail of Disney fandom.
But how did you get to go? How do you get into that? How do people know? It's because it's a membership thing,
right?
It was
not
an expensive...
free. Don't think for a moment it was not. But it was well worth it.
It's a private club that you have to be a member of generally, or you bring a guest, unless you have someone that brings you as a guest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
So there is nothing at all Disney-like about it. The menus don't have mice on them. There's no chandeliers. Were there any Mickeys in that whole dining room?
Not that I noticed. I mean, maybe because they do sell a few things of merchandise.
Yeah.
Maybe there, but I don't even remember it there.
No, it wasn't joyful, but it wasn't amusement park fair.
It was beautiful.
It's just
it was
a nice
gorgeous
restaurant.
Mm-hmm. It had beautiful views of the park, but it wasn't in-your-face Disney. It wasn't a theme restaurant.
Yeah.
And as of today, it's the only place where they serve alcohol. In the park, I believe.
I think that's true. I know in Magic
California,
in Orlando now.
I read it has its own address, which I think is where Club 33 comes from. And that's because they had to get a liquor license in order to be able to serve alcohol. And so, therefore, they had to have a legitimate street address for it. And so, I think it's the only place in the park that has a street address.
I think they definitely serve alcohol in California Adventure.
Yeah.
But in Disneyland, as far as I know, that's the only place. Yeah.
And I think they're going to start maybe serving alcohol in a new Star Wars.
I've heard
they're
that.
Doing something.
Yeah, something
right
now is happening.
They're
going to
finally bring it. Yeah. Because that's
what we need. There's that whole thing about the Masonic thing and 33 being the Masonic number, Disney being a Mason and 33s being an integral part of the park, all sorts of, this is 3 and that's 3. And there's supposed to be all sorts of really odd.
And Mickey's made up of 3 circles.
Yeah, right. Yeah. There's so many different theories about that. And, it's interesting because people do, when it becomes such an obsession like Disney is for people, they overanalyze everything. And,
While we're talking about security at the park and protecting things, there was a famous, It's called The Ultimate Guerrilla Film. A guy back in 2013, it came out. It was called Escape from Tomorrow. A guy shot a guerrilla horror film, guerrilla-style horror film, in Disneyland. Disney did not know he was doing it.
On iPhones, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, something they wouldn't notice.
I mean,
it
wasn't like iPhones.
It was like, or DSLR cameras or something that, you know, you couldn't tell that he was filming. And he brought his actors. His actors, they would go into the park every day to secretly film this movie. And they didn't get caught until it came out. And Disney, I think, chose to just ignore it. And I think it was a challenge for them to release it, and I don't know how high quality the film was considering how he had to film it, but yeah,
I think it was
that's
iPhones.
How he did it.
I think everyone did it on their iPhones.
Something like that, yeah.
But so, that was really clever.
Idea, yeah. They got him like on the character. His actors are on the rides in whatever their character is.
And I think
what great promo too,
right?
All done under Disney's nose.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the Carpenters were the only one that actually ever were given permission to actually film something at Disney, and they one of their music videos. I think it might have been Top of the World or Kind of Hush. I don't know what it was. But anyway, they did shoot on Disney. They were on the car, on the train with Mickey, et cetera. And that just not done. Not even for feature-length films, they don't go into Disney. Mm-hmm. That was just Carpenter's.
Well, now that Disney has ABC, they're becoming lax about that. It's like ABC shows. There was a episode of Modern Family that they did at Disneyland. And then a Blackish episode they did in Disney World. So they've gotten image because they own everything.
Yeah,
so.
They're about to own all television.
Well, I love how that guy can shoot in that park without getting caught. But Scott and I go on a tour in Hollywood and try to film a guerrilla thing talking about someone else's tour, and we get caught in like 40 minutes.
Oh my god! That's remember right, that we guy? Did do that. Yeah, that was nuts. Yeah,
we took someone else's tour. Basically, it was at we were trying to get a TV show going, and an agent had recommended that we do this as part of our like pitch reel. So we did it. We had Scott go on one of the somebody else's Hollywood celebrity tour, and we went on this tour, and it was Scott basically just secretly pointing out everything he was saying that was complete nonsense. Either that was never that person's home, or that person moved away 10 years ago,
yeah,
or whatever.
I mean, the first thing he said was that Grease was filmed at Hollywood High School. I mean, it was like 5 seconds into the
It was the first place we went by,
oh
I think.
God,
it was
yeah.
wrong.
It
like,
was
right
so
off the
bad.
Bat. Like,
so we were in the back.
We were in the very back row with it. We used a DSLR camera to try and be at least somewhat, you know, secretive.
Yeah.
And we hid the mic, you know, in your jacket. But I think you kept speaking into your jacket.
Yeah,
and I think he finally caught us. And he kind of freaked out.
Yeah, he was
to the point where I thought
because he was nominated to come up here and I'm alive some more for you guys.
Yeah,
and it was really uncomfortable.
He started to get a little weird, and it was right around the time we'd gone by the Michael Jackson Death House. We were over in that neighborhood, and I was like, "Is he going to kick us out here?" And we're going to have to like, it was pre Uber.
Really
like, how are we going to get home? There's no taxis in Los Angeles.
We had another hour of that tour to go, and after he busted us, and it was just like we wanted to die. We were in the back of that thing. It was like, oh my god, it was so awful.
Oh,
remember, it was like Jennifer Aniston's house, and you were like, yeah, like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then he was like Simon Cowell's house, and you're like, he lives nowhere near here.
Nuh-uh.
Like,
no, it was so bad. D. Martin's like, no.
I mean, what it came out to was maybe it was like 50-50. Like 50% were accurate or at least somewhat accurate, and probably the other half was
that
just completely
fun,
made up.
Right.
I think because what a lot of these tour companies do that are not Scott is they want to fit as much into the shortest route as possible.
All they need is all you got to do to get hired is get a driver's license. They don't even care if you speak English. No, I'm dead serious.
Yeah.
The first person to train me when I worked for that other big company when I first moved back from England couldn't even pronounce names. She would say a name and then she would have to spell it. Because you didn't, and it would be something like, you know, we'd be passing Agnes Moorhead's house, and she would say something, you're like, what the was that? And then she'd go, A-G-N-E-S. It was just so bad. And this person was given a bus full of tourists every 2 hours. Anyway, we know. But yeah, you're going to post a link to that, I assume, because people
maybe
should see that.
Yeah, if it's up, I will. If it's posted.
It still is.
It probably is, yeah.
How long ago was that?
It was about, 10 years ago?
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago.
Wow, okay.
Did we miss anything that you wanted to...
Oh, man.
Oh, there was a YouTube video of somebody, like, taking a dive off the steamboat, wasn't it, during Pantasmic?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
They just, like, fell down like levels.
Somebody fell off
yeah.
the steamboat.
Somebody in costume.
No!
It's a two-level steamboat, and something happened where they slipped, fell through the grate, landed, thankfully, on the bottom level, not in the water.
And they're just a head floating.
No, this did not happen. But yeah, that I mean,
which character was that? Do you remember?
It was Dopey.
Dopey. Oh yeah.
Well, that
yeah,
makes okay. That's good then. It probably was.
It was
people
in
probably
character.
Thought it. People, but people probably thought it was part of the show because it was Dopey, right?
Oh gosh. Speaking of, this is not while I was there. This was like a year ago, maybe, where one of the floats in the parade, the dragon, caught fire, and. Normally, this
dragon.
Keith's dragon? No, this is the newer parade that goes on in the afternoon, and this is technically it's Maleficent as a dragon, and it cruises through the park. It looks awesome. It has like a steampunk look to it, and it does blow fire from its mouth, and it does turn its head. But something I don't know whatever they determined went wrong, but it did catch fire and like the whole head engulfed in flames.
I think I remember this. There was video of it. Yeah
there
yeah.
is. There's plenty of video
probably,
about
probably
it.
Probably like 50,000 videos of it of everybody that was there watching it. Yeah,
yeah there was plenty. And these people are just like, oh, cool. The hallmarks of this parade is the dragon that blows fire.
It's the big moment.
And
yeah.
It's. I think this is toward the end of the parade that this float comes up, so the rest of the parade just continued, but the two things behind it had to go find somewhere else to go,
because
they were that float was parked there for hours. Like, it was a long time, and like
the staff with their bags.
Yeah. The staff, there was, I think they went through 24. It's either 12 or 24, so but still significant fire extinguishers.
They're like, send Goofy out there to blow his knee out again and distract people from our burning dragon.
Oh, look over there.
Something
there's
else.
Mickey. Follow him. I remember you told me that there was that viral video a couple of years ago where the guy that did the Beauty and the Beast thing, and he just called it Hey Girl. And it was just, it was Belle going through the whole, it was all, everyone was, hey girl.
Yeah.
And he told me that this is like every day at Disneyland.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Everyone's, I
love that. It's, I don't know, for lack of a better term, it can get pretty queeny. It's all like really fun and great people, and
even
it's
if you're
a blast.
Working at, like, even if you've got a job where you're making minimum wage or whatever, at least you're making minimum wage. And I'm not saying you did, and I'm not saying it was hellish or you got paid garbage. I don't know. But even if you consider it a job, and your job is to go into work and make people smile or get people to smile, I think it's got, you know, you walk out of there and I don't know, there's got to be an element of satisfaction. Oh, there's one thing I wanted to ask you. So as soon as you got cast in Disney, the one thing I thought of, which would have been really, I don't know, just a situation that I thought of, when you're as Mickey, and you can see clearly through his eyes, right? That's his eye holes, or is his
almost,
eyes?
Almost clearly, and yes, Mickey is through his eyes. It's
okay.
Not the same for every character.
So to me, I think it would be so weird to walk through the park as Mickey and watch everybody's head turn for probably hundreds of yards and come after you like zombies always coming after Mickey, you know, because he's such an attraction.
Yeah,
and then after your shift... to go out to the park without the head on and go, oh, wait a second, nobody sees me. That's got to be so weird.
Yes. For those few moments or whatever you're doing during your day, you're one of the Beatles. Like you're a rock star. And then I've met with families in character, and then on break I've been out in the park just as me, and I've been like, oh, hey, oh.
Who's this woman? Get her away from us.
This weird lady.
Yeah, so it's weird and amazing, because you get those 15 minutes of fame every day, and then you get to go home and be normal.
That's wild.
That is cool, because you know so many actresses deal with stalkers and stuff, and you don't have to deal with that when you're so long as you're one wearing a mask.
Yeah, yeah,
they don't,
exactly.
They don't recognize you away from the park.
Now I wonder if cast members at our characters, like if their IDs were released, like if somehow got out, like if people would stalk you.
I mean, I know face characters like princesses and stuff have gotten recognized
in person.
Yeah, like maybe they just didn't do a good enough job, like, you know, switching up their makeup or whatever. But I mean, they all wear wigs, so it's not the same hair, but people will still recognize their faces, and they'll be like, oh, Snow White, and like, no, but thank you, no, that's not, you know, they have to do the best they can. But I've never actually heard of like a stalker situation.
And can you tell people, like, outside of work, I'm Mickey, I'm Snow White, I'm so-and-so? Are you allowed to do that?
In training, they are very specific, saying that you can never tell anyone ever what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband, your mom, your dad,
please.
And they
wait,
do,
like your special forces,
CIA.
They try to, they do
freaking SEAL Team 6.
they try to even make it sound like the trainers try to make it sound like, you know, I've worked here for 10 years and I've never told my parents.
Disney's coming.
Yeah, I know. Here's coming the for sirens. I don't know. They can't fire
me
anymore.
She said too much.
She's in the tower. I can see her.
Oh, my God. There's going to be a van waiting for me outside.
But when it has hidden Mickeys on it, then you'll know what it is.
Just like in the hubcaps. There's just little spokes of Mickey.
Well, to bring this conversation into a weird full circle, I mentioned Three's Company earlier. You just talked about wigs. I just found out, watching my Three's Company box set and the commentary, that in the opening... the first two seasons, you know, the open is Jack falling off the bike into the zoo, that's later seasons.
Yeah.
The first two seasons, it's Jack riding his bike along Venice, the boardwalk, and a pretty girl walks by, and he falls off his bike into the sand.
That.
Remember that? The pretty girl walking by, we only see her from the back. It's Suzanne Summers. They put a wig on her.
Oh, really?
Because it was just shot spur of the moment. They didn't know what to do for the open, so they just ran out to the beach.
Your budget was probably like 50 cents.
Seriously, it really was. Because if you look at it, it's just them messing around on the beach, like, what are we supposed to do out here? And it's what they were going to run the credits over at the beginning and the end. But yeah, Suzanne Summers is the one that Jack ditches his bike for. She's just in a brown wig. So there you go.
You need some B-roll. Throw that way on.
Yeah. And with that...
Oh, it's been so much fun. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, fun.
And that was episode 4 of Dearly Departed Podcast.
A lengthy episode.
An especially long Dearly Departed podcast, but we had a special guest. And we hope to have more special guests on subsequent episodes when it calls
for
it.
But no one as special as you.
You were the first special guest.
I'm honored.
And we don't know what episode 5 is going to be yet, but you'll know in a couple weeks.
Can't wait.
All right, see you later.
I love doing this. I do. I really do.
It's fun, right?
Yeah.
I think people like it.
Bye.
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 This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.